which, well, it's always sort of been with us. I first came across it with the phrase looks maxing. And I thought, looks maxing, what's that? Well, that's looking, trying to look your best. And as you may probably know, some people go to extremes to try to look their best. They have surgeries, they starve themselves, they, one way or another, they do all kinds of things to make themselves look their absolute best, and they do so they can take great pictures. And they take great pictures and they'll put those pictures on Facebook or Instagram or YouTube, and so look maxing. But we've had all sorts of other maxing around. We've had money maxing, and really, I think in a lot of the internet, there's wisdom maxing. That people are hungry for wisdom. And that's a good thing. People should be hungry for wisdom, because you might look your best, but as I often say to people who are kind of shy, that like, don't they take my picture, I'll say, well, you know, you're probably not going to look any better than you look now. That's not really great news, but it's true. Because generally speaking, we sort of go downhill in that department. But if you're looking to max your wisdom, well, that's good. That's good. Figure out, a lot of people, how you can have your best life. But for a lot of people, they think, well, their life is just what they have between 0 and 100. So they figure out how to maximize it. But today we use chemistry and education and biology and economics and politics and education, and that's how we sort of try to max ourselves between 0 and 100. Now, in the ancient world, they did a lot of maxing too, but they would use the gods to maximize themselves. Last fall, when I had a chance to go back to the UK, one of the things I really wanted to do, if I got a little time, which I did, was to go to the British Museum, because for years, you know, you study the Bible and you see these images and they all say, British Museum, British Museum. In the 19th century, the British and the French were first to get on the archaeology train. And they went all over the world and they'd go to places and there's all this stuff laying in the ground, and the locals would say, yeah, there's all these ruins and stuff here. We took a bunch of stones to build our own buildings, but there's all kinds of useless stuff. And the British and French were like, this isn't useless, we'll take it. And people were like, yeah, take it away, it's always in the way. So the British Museum is filled with antiquities. And this was what one Assyrian emperor had on the walls of his palace. And you see the Assyrian emperor with his bow riding on a chariot, and you see the enemy that it's trodden underfoot of the great war horse. But up in the sky, there's this thing with these wings with its own bow. And you say, well, what's that? What's that, Fred? Well, yeah, and for the Greeks, it would be Ares, but yeah, it's a god. And the god is fighting for them. So if you were an Assyrian emperor, you really wanted to max yourself with the gods. And religions were all about working the gods and getting the gods on your side and making sure that there weren't gods against you, and doing all of that work to get your best life now. Now, last week we talked about Corinth, and we talked about how someone would have imagined that Corinth was the ideal place for the Apostle Paul to start a church, because it's sort of like in America, if you're going to fly someplace, everything goes through Chicago. Well, if you're going by ship in the Mediterranean, which was the main way they all went around, all of those ships would go through Corinth. And so to have a really great church in Corinth would be an awesome thing. And what's more, that Corinth, just like many important places in the world, it was filled with beautiful people and smart people and educated people and wealthy people. And usually in a church, you know, we sit around and, oh, we don't have enough money and we have all these problems. And then if someone drives a nice car into the parking lot, we think, oh, maybe they'll stay. And if they're beautiful and if they're politically well-corrected and if they're powerful and if they're wealthy, we think, oh, they're exactly the kind of people we want in our church. And so you think, well, that Corinthian church, that would be a great church. And then we read in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, and if you never read the book, you might think, oh, they must have been a wonderful church that Paul would have written so much to them. And then you read the letters to learn that, oh no, they were a mess of a church. That's why Paul had to write so much to them. We have more letters to Corinth than to any other church. There were deep problems in the church, and it had everything to do with their assumptions that they brought into the church from their being accustomed to the pagan gods. It's quite likely that in Corinth, where everybody understood you had Aphrodite or Venus, because of course the Romans sort of had versions of the Greek gods, but you have a god of love, and you have a god of war, and you have a god of ruling strength, and you have a god of cleverness in fixing things. You have gods to manage all of the little things in your life. And so then this new god comes along, this Jesus, and they think, well, maybe this Jesus has new stuff to give. People love new things. You see it all the time in marketing, new and improved. And so a bunch of people came into that Corinthian church thinking, well, maybe this new religion is a new and improved religion, and it can help me max who I am. And so then they'd hear stories about this Jesus who stilled the storm and raised the dead and healed the sick and all of those kinds of things. And then there were these apostles. And of course, as we saw last week, Paul. Well, Paul did miracles. So, you know, like if, again, I've used this illustration before, if suddenly miracles were to break out in this church, well, there wouldn't be empty chairs. All the churches, all the things would be filled, and people would be like, here, I want to see a miracle. I want it. And Pastor Paul did miracles. I want to know Pastor Paul because I need a miracle. I want a miracle. And so everybody's, well, Paul went through Corinth. Peter went through Corinth. All these wonder-working apostles went through Corinth. I want to be where the wonder workers are. Now, superpowers are funny things. We have all sorts of superhero stories these days. And most superhero stories are sort of told straight, where you have Superman or Batman, and they're fighting for the good, and they're using their powers, their superpowers, to do good things. Well, there's another sort of superhero story that's out there. It's I'm not going to recommend it. You don't need to actually watch it to get the idea of it. It's sort of inverted, and it's called The Boys. And basically, the story goes like this. Some mad scientist invented a drug called Compound V and learned that if you injected this into children when they were very, very young, they would grow up and have superpowers. And the thing about most of our superhero stories is that these superheroes have character, like Superman. Sometimes people call him Spandex Jesus, you know, because Superman always does the right thing. Well, the people who wrote The Boys said, you know, if you give a bunch of people superpowers, you know what they're probably gonna do? They're gonna do for themselves. Sure, they're gonna present themselves to the public as if they're fighting for truth, justice, and the American way, but really, they're just trying to get what they want. And so they look like superheroes, but what they really are supervillains. Because power corrupt, and superpowers corrupt superbly. Now, if you combine the advantages in Corinth and their assumptions that, well, maybe Jesus can help them max out their life, you get sort of a mess, which is exactly what Paul found. Last week we read how there were divisions in the church. Well, why were there divisions? It was because they're scrapping with each other. They're trying to take advantage of each other. And again, we noted when we went through Corinthians about a year or so ago that it's so bad that Paul says, you know, when you come together to eat the Lord's Supper together, Y'all are so bad, maybe you should just stop altogether because it's a mess. You have a church in which it brings the worst of both worlds. Religions used to max themselves, the status, access, network, and power to really warp the whole thing, which is why last week Paul comes to them and says, you know what I want to be known for preaching? I don't want to be known for doing miracles. I don't want to be known for having snakes bite me and surviving. I don't want to be known for all of these things. I want to be known for the cross of Christ. And we talked about last week, that's a strange thing because, of course, for us, we see these crosses and we think religion. But can you imagine if we had a guillotine up there? People would be like, oh, why would you put something like that on a building? Well, that's how Romans thought about a cross. So then Paul says in chapter 12, after he's finished telling them how they're doing the Lord's Supper so poorly, now about the gifts of the Spirit, brothers and sisters. And now I'm sure some of them are thinking, oh, finally we're getting around in this letter to what we really want to know. Because what I really want is some of that compound V flowing through my veins. So when I go to church, I can do the super stuff. Now about the gifts of the Spirit. I do not want you to be uninformed. You know that when you were pagans, somehow or other, you were influenced and led astray by mute idols. Therefore, I want you to know that no one who is speaking by the Spirit of God says, Jesus be cursed. And no one can say, Jesus is Lord, except by the Holy Spirit. Now this, to us, seems kind of weird, because for a few thousand years already, we're pretty ardent monotheists. But the way they looked at the world was there were all these spirits. And that sort of makes sense if you think about it. Because, well, when you see someone fall in love, it seems to possess them. And they begin doing strange things, like buying chocolates and flowers, or dressing up to see some poor sap that we all thought was just a regular schmo. But we'll say, well, Cupid shot them. And is sort of possessing them. And when we get angry, well, it's sort of like something else takes over. And the ancients looked at that and said, well, there's the spirit of anger, or there's the spirit of love. And so there were all these spirits, and Paul comes and says, now the one God gives lots of spirits. And we think, and they thought, oh, well, that's interesting. It's not a god here and a god there, the temple of Aphrodite and the temple of Zeus and the temple of Ares and the temple of Apollo. No, it's one God. Okay. And it's marked by loyalty to Jesus is how you recognize him. And there are different kinds of gifts, but the same Spirit distributes them. There are different kinds of service, but the same Lord. There are different kinds of working, but in all of them and in everyone, it is the same God at work. So it's not all these Greek gods. It's one God giving different things to different people. That's a new idea to them. Now, to each one, the manifestation of the Spirit is given for the common good. In other words, this gifting that you have is not for you. It's not for you to max so that you can have all sorts of power and influence and fame and prestige or whatever it is you desire. The gifts that you've been given are for everyone in the body. Oh, that's a very different way of thinking. To one, there was given the Spirit a message of wisdom. To another, a message of knowledge by means of the same Spirit. To another, faith by the same Spirit. To another, gifts of healing by that one Spirit. To another, miraculous powers. Oh, yeah, pay attention. That's the one I want. Let's keep our eye on the miraculous power thing. To another, prophecy. Oh, but that's good too, you know. I know. There's someone in this church. Your car is going to break down. How would he know that? Lots of cars. to another distinguishing between spirits, to another speaking in different kinds of tongues, and still another interpretation of tongues. To all these are the work of one and the same Spirit, and he distributes them to each one just as he determines. Oh, I really want the spirit of miraculous things. I really want the compound V spirit. I really want the super spirit. Oh, okay. You might not get that one. Just as a body, though one, has many parts, but all its many parts form one body, so with Christ. For we are all baptized into one spirit, so as to form one body, whether Jews or Gentiles, slave or free. And we were all given the one spirit to drink. Even so, the body is not made up of one part, but of many. Now if the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? Now again, they're all thinking, I want to have the super spirit. No. You're going to have your part to play. Well, I don't like my part. I'm kind of sorry about that, but truth is, we're all role players. But in fact, God has placed the parts in the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. If they were all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, but one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. And the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. Ever see a head rolling around on the floor? Not a good sign. You need feet, and the head should be attached to them. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts that we think less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty. While our presentable parts need no special treatment, but God has put the body together, giving greater honor to the parts that lacked it, so that there should be no division in the body. Now, giving greater honor to the parts that lacked it. Remember that whole cross thing? Remember that weakness thing? Yeah. So that there should be no division in the party. In the body, unlike Corinth, but that its part should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. That's how the body should work. Now you are the body of Christ, church in Corinth, and each one of you is a part of it. The slaves and the free, the Jews and the Gentiles, all the different parts. You're all part of one body. And God has placed in the church, first of all, apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healing, of helping, of guidance, and of different kinds of tongues. Are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Do all work miracles? Do all have gifts of healing? Do all speak in tongues? Do all interpret? Now eagerly desire the greatest gift. And think, okay, finally, pulse, all body, get to the point. I want the compound V. I want the super gifts. I want the super spirit. I want to be able to do super things. And Paul says, okay, I'm going to tell you the biggest, the best, the most important gift, the greatest gift, and the most excellent way. And they're all waiting and thinking, here comes the compound V. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, yeah, that sounds pretty good. If I can speak the tongues of everyone, if I can, don't have to bother learning languages of all these people coming through Corinth. who do not have love, I am a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. And the irony of that, of course, is the gift of tongues. Maybe I can speak all of those languages. And Paul is saying, if you can speak every language in the world, but don't have love, you have nothing to say. You're just making noise. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, yeah, that's a good one. Gift of prophecy. Someone's car will break down, and Carol's like, please, not me again. If I can have all knowledge, if I can understand how things work, and I can see through things, and I can manage things because I know so much, if I know all of this stuff, and have faith that can move mountains, yeah, that would be a handy one. But do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor, oh yeah. Yeah, you know, that's a gift. Not sure I really want that one, but I sure like it when someone else has it and they have a lot. Because that's really impressive. If someone just gives sacrificially and they're always helping and they're always serving and they're so selfless, because yeah, the cross, yeah, that's really, really Christian. And when someone does that, that's really, really spiritual and that's really, really profound. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, I'm maxing so much that it's so funny we have this whole six-pack meme in our culture, because when I lived in the Dominican Republic, if you lifted up your shirt, everybody could see the details of your stomach muscles because you have so little body fat. People in the Dominican Republic and Haiti would look at you and say, yeah, you're poor, you don't have enough to eat. Here in America, we lift up our shirt and say, and all the people in the third world say, boy, somebody should feed those poor Americans. You can see their stomach muscles. I give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love. All of that sacrifice for others, all of that, I gave away all my money, I gave away all my time. Whenever there was a problem, I was the one there serving, but have not love. All of that sacrifice bought you nothing. This is the greatest gift? Right now, this gift doesn't seem like it makes any sense at all. What is this gift? Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always trusts, always protects, always hopes, always perseveres. Now, you see, the funny thing about this is, we want to be around people like this, but so often we don't want to be these people, because this world is so hard to these people. I made a video last week where I talked about Edith Bunker, and some of you remember Edith Bunker from All in the Family. And a lot of people didn't respect poor Edith because, you know, Archie didn't treat her that well. And, you know, Edith was always running around making food for Gloria and Mike and Archie and the neighbors. Everybody, a lot of people really loved Edith, but they sure didn't want to be her. Do you know the thing about Edith? Edith loved these people that were really miserable. Edith even loved Archie. Now everybody looked at Archie and said, Archie's a mess. But she loved even Archie Bunker. Paul says, you want to know the greatest gift? Here is the greatest gift. To be able to love. Patient. Kind. Does not envy. Does not boast. Edith Bunker would never boast. is not proud. She was never proud. She didn't dishonor others. Her husband, he was rude. She was never rude. She wasn't self-seeking. She wasn't easily angered. It took a lot for Archie to get her angry, but it would happen. She keeps no record of wrongs. She didn't delight in the evil, but rejoiced with the truth. She loved it if her daughter or a loved one had something good happen to them. She was the first one to rejoice with them. Always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. It doesn't. Still today, and for 1,000 years, people who loved, boy, we're impressed by that. We don't think we might want to be that way, but there's something there. Where there are prophecies, they'll cease. Yeah, everybody will come and see the big show, but the show will end. Where there are tongues, they'll be still. Yeah, they will. Where there's knowledge, it will pass away. It does. Every generation forgets what the last generation learned. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child, and when I became a man, those childish ways were obsolete. And now, this is subtle here, but what Paul is saying is that all of this stuff that the Corinthians want to be, it's all going away. And what endures is love. For now we see only reflection in a mirror, and then we will see face to face. Now I know in part, and then I will know fully, even as I am fully known. Now these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. I told the story on the estuary group, and 2 weeks ago, someone sent me a little clip from Scott Adams. Scott Adams wrote Dilbert. Scott Adams has made a social media presence for himself for a whole bunch of different reasons. He's an atheist. He's cynical. He's dismissive. He's condescending. Can be kind of a jerk online. Hasn't had much success in love and marriage or children. Every now and then, you hear his bitter side. And he made a video where he basically said, you know, the best times I ever had, he's been in relationship with beautiful women. The best times in my life were when I would take my stepdaughter and watch her play Little League soccer. And if I don't know if it's true that when you die, your life flashes before your eyes, but when I think of a moment that is my life, I think about sitting and watching Disney movies with my stepkids. He says, the Dilbert books, the money, all of that stuff, but he says it mournfully because the stepkids are gone and the Disney movies aren't what they used to be. Now he looks back at his life and, these are eulogy virtues, not resume virtues. Paul says, you see it every time you go to a funeral. Yeah, there might be a mention about some great thing that they did, but when people come forward, what do they say? They were my boss, and they treated me well. That's what gets remembered. Paul is right. Now, here's the thing. There's two lines in this world. There's the line to be loved. Everybody wants to be loved. On TV, you find it. When you watch The Bachelor, the most beautiful people that ABC can find in America, bring them all together. It's like blood sport. And they're all sitting there in front of the camera. When will I be loved? I deserve to be loved. And you're looking at these people and it's like, boy, anybody who looks like you should be able to find a boyfriend or a girlfriend like that. And then you listen to their stories and so-and-so cheated on me and I couldn't make the relationship work. It's because you never learned how to love. Yeah, being loved is easy. Loving someone, that's hard. It's costly. All of those things that Paul mentioned. So there's a huge line. Everybody wants to be loved. But to love and to attend to someone? No line there. You want to love? Everybody out there wants to be loved. Just go find somebody and love on them. Give them a ride. Do something for them. Be kind. Pay attention. Everybody's willing to receive that. Now, to connect it to the cross of Christ, the cross of Christ and love as the greatest gift comes together. It is love that allowed and allows God to be patient with our rebellion against him. It is love that motivated God to send his son. It is love that motivated God's son to present himself as a sacrifice while we were yet sinners. Christ is our Savior because he first loved us. Christ is our model because he first loved us when we were not so easy to love. And we're still not so easy to love. You know it. I know it. We just all think everybody else is harder to love than me. Oh, yeah, right. The way of Christ is the way of life. The way of love is the way of life. Every child knows it. What does it take to raise a child? It takes love. And that love then brings how many other things? This is where we get to the part of this meal and why Paul said, you know, you might as well cut that thing out because you don't know anything about it. Well, why don't they know anything about it? Because this whole meal is about love. It's all about love. And we don't just remember it in our minds. We remember it at the table. And we're reminded about it because that's what this is about. Now, on the night in which Jesus was betrayed, now that betrayal, well, it's all right there. Because if you're a total stranger, you can't betray anyone because there's nothing to betray. And it was one of the 12 that Jesus had chosen that betrayed the love that Jesus had for Judas. On that night he was betrayed, he took bread and he broke it. And he said the strangest thing. Again, we have heard it, some of us, so often it doesn't even register. But it must have just confused and baffled the disciples and been so strange that they remembered it. Remember, he took that bread and he broke it and he said, this is my body broken for you. Now, every mother can say this to their child. They can look at their body and say, honey, this is my body that I broke for you. Jesus says to all of us, this is my body broken for you. And what do we think about? We think about that cross. And what do we think about that cross and love? That when we eat this bread, we remember, oh yeah, his body was broken. Because of his love for me. And then we think, that's how we are to be to each other. That was Paul's point to them in Corinth. That's the greatest gift. Your greatest hero, he's right there on the cross. And there's no superpower greater than that. And he says, you want to try it? Here. I'll give it to you.